Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Text number 49 and 50, thank you. We'll chant 49 together.
Grihit arhanamasinam Sangyatam Prinayan Munihi Smaran Bhagavadadesham Ityaha Slakshnaya Gira Grihit Arhanamasinam Sangyatam Prinayan Munihi Smaran Bhagavadadesham Ityaha Shlakshnaya Gira. Grihita, received Arhanam. Honor asinam, seated samyatam, remained silent, prinayan, delighting munihi, the sage, smaran, remembering Bhagavat of the Lord, Adisham, the order, iti, thus, aha, spoke, slakshnaya, sweet, gira, with a voice. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. After receiving the sage's attention, the king sat down and was silent. Recalling the instructions of the Lord, Kardama then spoke to the king as follows, delighting him with his sweet accents. No purport. I'll read the next verse. Nunam chankramanam deva satam samrakshanayate vadaya cha satam yastvam harik shaktir hipalini.
Translation: the tour you have undertaken, O Lord, is surely intended to protect the virtuous and kill the demons, since you embody the protecting energy of Sri Hari. Purport: it appears from many Vedic literatures, especially histories like Srimad Bhagavatam and the Puranas, that the pious kings of old used to tour their kingdoms in order to give protection to the pious citizens and to chastise or kill the impious. Sometimes they used to kill animals in the forest to practice the killing art, because without such practice, they would not be able to kill the undesirable elements. Kshatriyas are allowed to commit violence in that way, because violence for a good purpose is a part of their duty. Here these two terms are clearly mentioned, vadhaya for the purpose of killing, and asatam, those were undesirable. The protecting energy of the king is supposed to be the energy of the Supreme Lord. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says, paritranaya
sadhu nam vinashaya chatushkritam. The Lord descends to give protection to the pious and kill the demons. This potency, therefore, to give protection to the pious and kill the demons, or undesirables, is directly an energy from the Supreme Lord. And the king or the chief executive of the state is supposed to possess such energy. In this age, it is very difficult to find such a head of state who is expert in killing the undesirables. Modern heads of state sit very nicely in their palaces and try, without reason, to kill innocent persons. Maybe you don't have a taste for this violence, then don't get involved in Kshatriya business. Don't try to be a ruler. If you're a Brahmana, then if you're Brahminical by nature, then don't get involved in politics. Because a proper Kshatriya has to be able and ready to use violence in the execution of his duty. The Greek philosopher Plato, he wrote a textbook, theoretical textbook on ideal politics called the Republic, Res Publica, in Latin. I don't know what it's called in Greek. in which he presents what he thinks would be an ideal government. He doesn't like democracy, neither did Prabhupada. You know, it's a traditional idea that democracy is not so good. Ruled by the common people. Prabhupada called it demon crazy. And Plato also thought that democracy is not a good idea, even though he was living in a democracy. Athens was a pure democracy. Not only did you get to vote for your elected representatives who ruled the country for you, but all the citizens ruled. At least the citizens who were what we call franchised, they had the right to vote. Only the men who owned a certain amount of property. Women forget it. Slaves forget it. Anyone who didn't have land, didn't own enough property, forget it. But those who had the status of enfranchised males, they were allowed to vote. And all those men got together and decided everything. They sat together in the forum and voted on what to do about all the matters of state, whether to have a war, whether to tax, whether to punish someone to be killed. That same forum decided to kill Plato's guru, Socrates. Now, the problem with such a democracy is that you get demagogues, people who speak nicely and can persuade the assembly to make some foolish decision. And they can distort the way of the government by their demagogic influence. That's the bad side of democracy, that wicked people can influence the voters. And then you get a dictatorship. Democracy turns into dictatorship. So Plato didn't like democracy. He liked a kind of monarchy, but he thought there should be philosopher kings. You should get a philosopher and make him the king. The philosopher should rule. But that's not practical. You want to put the brahmanas in the position of the kshatriyas? Philosophers are too soft. They don't know how to use violence. Brahmanas don't have a taste for violence. And if you have a king, he may be the smartest person in the country. He may be a great philosopher. He may even understand the absolute truth. But he may be a devotee of God. But if he doesn't know how to use violence, then he's going to be a lousy king. We have cases of that. I don't mean to get into so many mundane topics, but King Edward II, not Edward II, Edward III of England. It was Henry the Fifth, any one of these Henrys or Edwards. He was very pious man. He was always praying. He was always going into ecstasies and, you know, going into fits of prayer. But he was a horrible king. The country fell into chaos because of him, and then eventually he had to be assassinated. Such a pious man, but he was a horrible king. He couldn't rule. He was always, Edwin was in the clouds, in some fit of ecstasy. He couldn't manage anything. And certainly he didn't have the willpower to exert force. to use violence to defeat his enemies. He let his enemies defeat him. That's a philosopher king. A philosopher king is useless. We need a kshatriya king. The kshatriya has to be able and ready to use danda, the stick, and not the cowherd boy just hitting the cow on the backside with a stick. But this is vadha, the power of taking away someone's life. If he simply breaks the rules of the government. You know, nowadays we have such restrictions on capital punishment. In some countries it's outlawed altogether. No capital punishment. Don't kill anybody. Of course, they're killing so many people. The manufacturers of poisonous substances like cigarettes, they're killing hundreds of millions of people. Millions of people. Millions of people are dying of lung cancer because of cigarettes. So the killing is going on, even in a so-called place, a country where it's illegal for the government to kill anybody. There's even one country I know of where they outlawed the army. Costa Rica has no army. They decided to get rid of it. Yeah. But then in a non-violent state, so much violence is there because the persons who are not kept under control by the government, they're killing. By poisoning people, by killing babies in the womb, and so on. If the unruly citizens, those who were unscrupulous, are not kept under strict control by the government, if they're not eradicated if necessary, then things get out of hand. And then there's excessive violence in the state, chaos. So the king, the government, has to use violence in the real world. This goes back to the Supreme Lord. The government, the king, is only manifesting the power of God. He's the representative of God. So the original wielder of the stick is Krishna. Dando damayatamasmi. I'm that stick of punishment. Anyone you see with that stick in his hand, I'm the stick, Krishna says. Dando damayatamasmi. I'm the force of punishment. And we see it in Krishna's hands. Every time a material universe is created, Lord Shiva is deputized to be ready to destroy it. Not just at the end. Yes, at the end he dances his Tandava Nritya and destroys the universe. But he's constantly destroying. There's Nitya Pralaya. When I put a mango on the table and leave it there for a week, it rots. That's the power of Lord Shiva. He deputizes the microbes to invade the fruit and make it rot. That's Nitya Pralaya, constantly going on. If you're over 30 years old, your body is disintegrating. It's falling apart, getting sick. You're struggling constantly against disease. Sometimes young people, but certainly if you're over 30 years old, you're dying more than you're growing. That is the power of Lord Shiva to destroy. And that's Krishna's power given to him. Everything material is meant to be destroyed. It's just a question of when, how long it will be before it's destroyed. So Krishna is the destroyer. Kalo smi. Loka kshaya krit. I am time, the destroyer of the worlds, of everything in the world. Krishna is Ishavasyam Idam Sarvam. He's the ruler, controller, proprietor, possessor of everything. But he's also the destroyer of everything. And he has a right. If I own something, I can destroy it. If I have clear title to something, if I purchased a car, but I still owe money to the bank, then I have no right to destroy the car. At least I have to pay all the money. No, I can pay all the money and also destroy the car. But if I'm renting a car, then I have no right to destroy it. If I own it, then I can do what I want with it. I can take it apart and sell the pieces, or I can just for fun drive it off a cliff and destroy it if I want to. It's mine. And similarly, everything that exists is the property of Krishna. Ishavasyam idam sarvam. So we shouldn't say that he has no right to destroy it, that it's wrong for him to destroy it. It's his. As he sees fit,
He can maintain it, or when he sees fit, he can destroy it. And he sees fit that it should be destroyed periodically. The universe should not continue perpetually. That's Krishna's plan. Everything should be destroyed. Every material situation should not be permanent, should be temporary. Because the living entities have to learn detachment. They have to give up their childish urges to enjoy this world, so it has to be taken away from them. Like a child who's playing. You have to allow the child to play. But not forever. Especially if he's of school age. He can play a few hours, but he has to go to school. He has to brush his teeth in the morning. He has to eat his breakfast with everybody else and get on the school bus. He's not allowed to play all the time. He can play when he comes home from school for a few hours. So the living entities are playing with Maya, but when the time comes, the toys have to be taken away from them. That's the destruction of everything in the material world. It has to be done for the living entity's own good. They have to learn, they have to go to school and learn their lessons. So we have to learn our lessons from Maya by having our toys taken away from us periodically. And then we suffer. Then we lament. And we learn something. The suffering and lamenting we can do without, but we have to learn. If we're smart, we'll learn without the suffering and lamenting. We can learn from Shastra. We don't have to learn from practical experience, from the school of hard knocks. We can learn just by studying the Shastra. If we're Brahmanas, we can read Vedanta Sutra and so many other Shastras. If we're not Brahmanas, we can study the Upanishads or listen to the Panditji recite the Mahabharata and Puranas for us. Even if we're not learned, we can hear from the Mahabharata, Puranas, from the Bhagavatam, from the Ramayana. And learn by hearing that this world is a place of suffering and frustration. Give it up. And we can learn the lesson theoretically just by hearing it and avoid the suffering. That's first class intelligence. And you don't have to be a pundit. You don't have to be a PhD to have that first class intelligence. You just have to have common sense, humility, and honesty. Anye tvaivam ajananto, Krishna says. Anye tvaivam ajananto, shudvanyebhya upasate. Yes, there are many Jnana yogis and Karma yogis, very elevated souls, some who study the Upanishads and Vedanta, some who practice yoga for purification of their consciousness, some who perform sacrifices very diligently for self-purification and elevation. And there are other people who are no big Jnanis, no big yogis, no big karmis, just ordinary people. But if they listen to those who are highly situated, to the elevated souls, if they simply hear with faith, shudvanyebhya, by hearing from others who know, upasate, they can be lifted to the platform of actually meditating on the Supreme. Upasana means worship, but more technically it means meditation, devotional meditation. In the Upanishads, the term upasana means method of meditating on the Supreme. And the Upanishads teach a number of different upasanas, ways to meditate on the Supreme Absolute Truth, in different concepts, different methods. That's called upasana. So, by hearing from others, you can also be trained up in upasana, in Krishna consciousness, in meditating on the Supreme. You don't have to be a scholar, but you have to be willing to listen. So many scholars can't listen. They can talk, but they can't have a conversation. You can't have a conversation with them because they can't listen. No real communication. Jai Shri Gurnitai, Shri Krishna Balaram. So one can, even if he's not learned or anything special, he can develop first-class intelligence and avoid the lamentation and frustration that has to come. That means you voluntarily put your toys away and go to school without fighting, and then you don't suffer. We cannot have to suffer. We don't have to suffer. We have to learn our lesson, but we can do it voluntarily and avoid the suffering. We can listen. We don't have to be able to read and study on our own. We don't have to be scholars, but we do have to be listeners. We have to hear from the right people who know. We don't know, just listen to those who do know them. That for us is our acharyas, especially Srila Prabhupada. He's our founder, Samstapaka Acharya. He's the first person we should be listening to. And in pursuit of being a follower of Srila Prabhupada, we can listen to his other followers. And we can listen to the predecessor acharyas. And for practical matters, we can listen to various people. But we should learn how to listen. Shrutva. Krishna in his instructions to Arjuna, he says this over and over again. Shrinu me, listen to me. You can count 30 times, especially in the 18th chapter, and throughout the Gita. Krishna's telling Arjuna, Shrinu, please listen. That's practically Krishna's most important instruction. You can boil it down to one word, please listen. I have something to say to you. If a person can't listen, then there's no communication. Process of spiritual communication has to be established through the proper protocol. Panipatena, paniprashnena seva. How does it begin? Tadvidhi panipatena paniprashnena sevaya. Upadikshyanti te gyanam gyaninas tatvadarshina. So it says upadish. The verb dish is there. And it has a ksha in there because it's future tense. So it sounds like diksha. But it's not exactly saying that he's going to give you initiation. This is actually upadish means to point out. Giving knowledge and giving initiation are actually two different things, although they're connected. The same person normally does both. But shiksha and diksha are two different things. Diksha is a formality. Diksha is required. You have to get the mantra officially. Just like you want to purchase something, you have to sign a contract and make an official deal. You want to buy a house. You normally don't buy a house. Oh, in India you do, but in the West you have to go to a real estate dealer and you have to get certified from the bank and so many government regulations have to be fulfilled. Even in India, there's some government regulations for purchasing a house. Although, with enough bakshish, you can avoid everything. But there are regulations. There's official way to do. So diksha is official. Officially establishing your connection with Krishna and his sampradaya of devotees. But shiksha is a different thing. Although the same person may be giving you the shiksha and the diksha, they're two different things. Instruction. So what the verse that I recited is talking about is instruction. Upadekshyanti. The tattvadarshis, those who know the absolute truth, will show you the absolute truth. Not with their fingers. Usually it's not done like that. Here's Krishna over there, on top of that cloud. No. They point out by giving you verbal instruction. By their words, they point out. But how do you initiate that conversation? There's a protocol, a method, standard method. Just like if you, I've said this many times, but you if you want to have a phone conversation, you've got to, you pick up the phone, someone rings you, you say hello. And the person who called you is supposed to announce who he is. Otherwise, who are you talking to? You don't know. It's not that you have to tell him you picked up the phone. He's calling you. It's not that you have to tell him who you are. He has to tell you who he is and what his business is. He called. There's a protocol. So the protocol for establishing a spiritual communication, receiving divine knowledge, pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya. You come and bow down. You submit yourself. That my business here is not to argue with you, not to waste time gossiping. I'm here for serious instruction, and you're the one who knows more than me, so I'm the student and you're the teacher. That's what's signified, that's what's expressed by pranipata, by bowing down. Okay? It's not that, you're like a dog, puts his head on the ground. The dogs do it to each other. The little dog submits to the big dog by bowing down, pranipata. That means, that's what that symbolizes among the dogs, is that I'm helpless. You can kill me if you want. You can bite my head off. Okay, so that's one meaning, one way of what one idea of what pranipata can mean. I'm putting my head on the floor, and you can smash my head if you want. I'm not protecting myself. You know, the dog is showing the other dog, I'm not going to bite you. I'm not going to fight you. You can bite me instead. I'm submitting to you. You're the authority. You're the big dog. I'm the little dog, and I have to submit. But when you approach a spiritual master, it's not the same thing. I'm putting my head on the floor, and if you want, you can take your club and smash me with it. No. The idea is that I want to be your student. And I'm telling you that you know more than me, and I'm not going to argue with you. That's the idea of bowing down to the spiritual master. It's different than bowing down to the emperor, you know, who has the power. He's got his club in his hand. And if when you bow down, if he doesn't like you, he can beat you in the head. But the guru is not going to do that. He may chastise you, but that's different. That's verbal. He's carrying the, you know, the club of chastisement, but that's verbal. And you begin, you establish a relationship with a prospective guru by letting him know that you don't want to argue with him or waste time talking nonsense. You want to receive instruction, and therefore you accept the position of inferior, of student. Without that, there is no serious education, even material. That's why in India, the culture is there that you're supposed to show pranam to your teacher. Because nowadays, no one can manage to reach lower than the knees. You know, they grab at your knees, and that's supposed to be obeisances, pranam. They can't actually put their head on the floor or even touch your feet, forget it. You know, they touch your knees. That's modern version of pranam. Not even touch them, they just wave at your knees sometimes, not even touch them. But something is there, some vestige of the idea that you should show submission to your teacher. On any level, even the most mundane level. That's the beginning of the spiritual protocol, the right methodology for establishing a spiritual communication or any real educational process. Pariprashna. And then you tell him what you need to know. Don't expect that he can know everything by telepathy or just magic, that he can read your mind. Maybe he can. But the standard procedure is to ask relevant questions and tell him what your problem is. And then seva. Be ready to do service. Samitpani Brahmanishtam. One should approach teacher with firewood in your hands. Meaning that you're ready to do some service. They're not just there, I'm going to, you know, read the books 12 hours a day, and I'm not going to help out in the ashram. I'm here to study. I'm not going to do any work. I'm a Brahmin. Forget it. If you're a student, even if your father's a great rishi, we don't care. You came here as a student. You should be ready to do some service. Firewood in your hands, broom in your hands, ready to sweep and clean. That is the third step of the protocol. If you're not ready to do service, don't expect you're going to get much of an education. Yeah. Don't be lazy. This is the protocol for getting spiritual education so that you don't have to go out and learn the hard way. Avoid suffering in this life. Come to the Brahminical platform. Learn what you have to learn from your teachers, so you don't have to learn it by being beaten over the head by Maya. You didn't want to come and put your head on the floor and submit yourself to a teacher. Now you're going to be knocked down on the ground by Maya. You go out in the hard, the cruel world and try to fend for yourself. Maya will knock you down over and over again. She'll beat you so that your head ends up on the floor if you didn't do it voluntarily. So anyway, we should try to avoid having to learn everything the hard way by hearing from Shastra. Tasmat Shastram Pramanam Te Karya Karya Vivastitao. We should, as Krishna advised Arjuna, take Shastra as your authority. Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. But Shastra is an important part too. In understanding what should be done and what should not be done. In every question of life, a Brahman, every decision of his life, even little ones from day to day, he always thinks,
what's the right thing to do according to Shastra? What should I do? What should I not do? You know, which hand should I touch something with? Should I not touch it? Or before I touch it, what do I have to do? How do I purify the situation before I touch anything? Like, I just scratched my head, I shouldn't have. Yeah. Brahman is always thoughtful to what's right and what's wrong according to Shastra. Shastra is ruling his life. So Krishna advises that. Be like that. Then you don't have to be ruled by the kicks of Maya every day from moment to moment. We can see these two great souls, Kardama and Swayambhuva Manu. They're both living according to the dictates of Shastra. One is a Kshatriya, the other is as a Brahmin sage. But both of them are faithful to the Shastra, and therefore both of them are happy, satisfied, and well-situated. And when they get together, they can have a very fruitful interchange. They can work together peacefully and productively because they listen to the Shastra. Then they avoid quarrel and suffering and frustration. Okay, so I'll stop. Any questions or comments? Hare Krishna. Yeah, yeah.
How does gyan transform into vigyan?
By practice, by seeing it, not just hearing about it theoretically, but experiencing it. In practical matters, it means just getting some experience. You learn theoretically how to fly a plane. When you actually sit in the plane and fly it, that's vijnana. When you've actually flown for a few hours, then you've got some vijnana. So on different realms, on more subtle realms, it's a more subtle thing, how you get practical experience. It's inside. It's all inside. So spiritual matters, you have to actually become self-realized to get vijnana. That means to see God face to face. That's, you know, in Krishna consciousness. That means you act Krishna, you will actually see Krishna. First in your heart. But then when you become more advanced, he'll show himself outside too, outside your heart. You'll see him externally. That's vijnana on the level of Krishna consciousness. Pratyakshavagamam dharmyam. Krishna says that this divine knowledge is really meant to be seen with your own eyes. But when we're talking about the knowledge or the matter of actually establishing our relationship with Krishna, the vijnana of that is to actually realize our swarupa, our relationship with Krishna, and enter his pastimes. That's, you know, the ultimate thing, and who knows when we'll achieve it, but that's vijnana. Otherwise, it's all theoretical. Until you actually are playing with Krishna, or performing your service to him, your eternal swarupa, it's all theoretical. If you're smart, you can avoid it. If you're sattvic, you can avoid it. If you're rajasic, you have to be beaten. A rajasic person has to suffer. You know, he can indulge in sense gratification, and in proportion, he has to suffer. A sattvic person minimizes his involvement in sense gratification and almost no suffering. He can live a peaceful, satisfied life. Okay. Hare Krishna. I thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.